indulge in whatever they could get their hands on to increase their wealth or their riches or their fame or what have you. And in return, they deprive people of their essential items in life. And this is why we have this equilibrium in living status. For example, I was watching that show called History 101, and they were giving numbers, the amount of money NASA spends each year on their whatever they're doing. Each year, the amount of money is in billions. And they said it's enough to cure or to eradicate world hunger. So if NASA decides for one, you say, you know what, leave Mars alone, leave the moon alone, leave the galaxy alone, let's look into our own people, human beings here. How about that money for 1 year we try to eradicate poverty and hunger from the entire world? But obviously there is a sense of corruption happening. I mean, obviously NASA itself, or even, you know, places like NASA, it's not like they themselves like taking all this money for research purposes, but most of it goes to places that no one knows about. And this happens also across countries where you have projects, for example, to serve humanity, for example, to build roads or irrigation systems or, buildings or things to serve mankind. But then those who are in charge of such projects, they keep most of the money in their pockets, and then they either delay the project itself, or they don't even begin doing it, or even if they do it, they would do a very sloppy job. They would do something just to tell people that we've done something, that's about it. And the rest goes unnoticed and unseen. So you have this kind of corruption happening, and like I said, it differs from country to country, from a person to person, because at the end of the day, the moral compass is corrupted, so everything else will be corrupted. So people don't care how much money they get and how much money they make, even if it means thousands and millions of people will suffer as a result of their greed and their corruption. And that's why we said it is very important for us to highlight that fact, that when it comes to human rights, it's not things that have to be direct in your face. So for us to say, well, that goes against the human rights. No, sometimes the things that no one sees, the things that go unnoticed, that sometimes we say, well, it doesn't concern me. Well, what if someone steals? What if someone does this? Well, the effect I and you will feel. Let us take a break and then we come back, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are still listening to the program For Humanity. As we mentioned earlier, that corruption happens in pretty much everywhere, in every country. If we want to look at the pyramid of corruption that happens, it happens on two levels. So at the top of the pyramid, you have the political corruption. And at the bottom of the pyramid, you have the, the actual organization of things, which is the base, which is the body and the foundation for everything else. So when you have departments, let's say, let's call them, Department of Home Affairs, for example, Department of Education, Department of this and Department of that, which lays the foundation of any system for people, that's the basic. And then you have the political head, which is the top of the pyramid, that deals with things outside the system. And sometimes when we look at the top of the pyramid, when we look at the political corruption, for example, when we look at the parliament members or senators or the president himself or his cabinet or even sometimes mayors of states or mayors of areas and suburbs or what have you. When these guys deal on political level, when they deal with corruption, it will affect everything under them. And obviously, if the one under them all corrupted themselves, then the corruption just becomes too much. And then the system collapses and people collapse. If we want to put that into an example, for example, you look at countries. They have wealth. For example, they have oil. They have mineral resources. They got gold. They got silver. They got iron, coal. They got uranium. They got a lot of things. But if you look at the state of the people themselves, you find them being very poor, where in fact they should be among the richest people on earth. And if corruption exists, then human rights will go out of the door. Inshallah, we'll see you in other programs. Until then, take care of yourselves. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صلي يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
In the limelight. The trade barriers that made the import of Marks and Spencer's Percy Pig Sweets one of the first casualties of Brexit has added an extra £600 million in costs to British importers since January, it has emerged. Customs duties paid by UK businesses shot up from £1.6 billion in the first half of last year to a record £2.2 billion in the same period this year, according to an analysis of HMRC data. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Lisa O'Carroll. The piece is titled, Brexit Trade Barriers Added £600 Million in Costs to UK Importers This Year. Trade barriers that made the import of Marks and Spencer's Percy Pig Sweets one of the first casualties of Brexit has added an extra £600 million in costs to British importers since January of this year, it has emerged. Customs duties paid by UK businesses shot up from £1.6 billion in the first half of last year to a record £2.2 billion in the same period this year, according to an analysis of HMRC data. Percy Pig Sweets were among 2,000 food product lines that were hit by rules of origin regulations that came into force with the Brexit trade deal on 1st of January. In January, Marks & Spencer's raised the prospect of Percy Pigs being subject to tariffs in Northern Ireland because of the rules of origin. Although manufactured in Germany, they were first brought to the UK before being re-exported to Ireland, a journey that would now be subject to import taxes because the tariff exemption in the trade fell away as soon as they were re-exported. The scale of the impact of these complicated rules on importers is only emerging now and gives the lie to the notion that a free trade deal is cost-free to businesses. Since then, thousands of businesses have found they have to pay taxes if the product they are importing under the trade and cooperation deal is not sufficiently manufactured in the European Union. Trade bodies are reporting that some companies find the rules so complicated that they end up just paying the customs duties for ease of trading. Michelle Dale, a senior manager at accountancy firm UHY Hacker Young, said, British businesses weren't given enough time to help to prepare for the cost of Brexit or the masses of paperwork involved. The result is that the cost of tariffs and extra paperwork is now causing serious difficulties for many British businesses who are already struggling to stay profitable in the face of mounting pandemic-induced costs. The rise in customs duties paid is directly attributed to Brexit, as they were not payable on goods imported from the European Union while Britain was in the single market. Under a trade deal, goods that are majority made or processed in the European Union can be imported without customs duties, with slight variations depending on the product. The Percy Pig issue is still an issue more than 8 months on for importers. Across the board, companies are still having difficulties getting to grips with rules of origin, said William Bain, the head of trade policy at the British Chamber of Commerce. If the exporter cannot provide a certificate of origin, then importers may not be able to provide sufficient proof over the origin of the product. And some are then saying it's just easier to pay the tariff, he added. Fergus McReynolds, the director of the European Union and International Affairs at Make UK, which represents the manufacturers, said businesses are still grappling with rules of origin and what import duties are payable on. Fergus McReynolds added, "We didn't actually see the black and white of the text until Christmas Eve, and that didn't give companies a lot of time to understand the implications." There is some anecdotal evidence that some companies have found the process difficult, and in order to continue trading, they're taking the option of paying the tariffs for ease of trading, he added. The rules of origin do not apply only to raw materials, but also to products that are modified in a European Union country and contain ingredients or components from outside of the European Union. If it is not deemed to be sufficiently processed in that country, then they may not comply with the rules of origin, said Fergus McReynolds. Manufacturing Northern Ireland has also identified difficulties for local traders importing from the United Kingdom. Earlier this year, Stephen Kelly, the chief executive of the trade body, told a select committee of an automotive company that was buying axles from a German supplier. Under the special arrangements for Northern Ireland, which is observing European Union rules, tariffs should not have applied to that trade. However, because the axle was first sent to Britain for modification, the rules of origin exemptions did not apply.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Alleged September 11th mastermind Khaled Sheikh Mohammed and four others appeared in a military courtroom at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba for the first time since the coronavirus pandemic began. 20 years after the attacks, the U.S. military is still in the pretrial phase of persecution of the suspects. The five are accused of war crimes in the 9/11 attacks that killed nearly 3,000 people 2 decades ago. If found guilty, they face execution. Meanwhile, human rights advocates say the trial is full of legal obstacles and it may never reach a satisfactory conclusion. The defense attorneys have tried to challenge the military commission's legitimacy to overturn the case by arguing that the CIA tortured the detainees in a secret prison before transferring them to Guantanamo. The defendants' lawyers accused the U.S. government of bringing the five suspects to Guantanamo Bay to continue covering up torture. They said the government's secrecy about the use of torture is the main reason that indefinite detention still exists at Guantanamo Bay. Since its establishment, the notorious prison has been under fire for the so-called enhanced interrogation methods used on inmates to force them to confess to crimes they might not even have committed. Interrogation methods which international human rights advocates say amounted to torture.
Primarily because it's designed to be an institution through which the U.S. Subverts the law, through which the U.S. Is able to commit torture, is able essentially to go beyond what is usually permissible. So questions such as the one that you posed, while it is relevant in an ordinary set of circumstances, in an ordinary concept of the rule of law, the blunt answer is the rule of law and judicial process and the implementation of any judicial process for the U.S. at least is irrelevant when it comes to Guantanamo Bay, or at least not a priority.
Experts say at the rate the case is proceeding, there could be another decade of procedural hearings. The Guantanamo Bay prison, also known as Gitmo, was established in southern Cuba in January 2002 to hold inmates in a place neither U.S. nor international law applied. Since then, Guantanamo has been synonymous with human rights abuses perpetrated by the U.S. government in the name of terrorism. At its peak, over 700 inmates have been held in the facility. However, only 7 have been convicted, including 5 as a result of pretrial agreements under which they pleaded guilty in return for a possibility of releasing from the base. Currently, nearly 40 inmates are incarcerated in Guantanamo without any charges. They're stuck in legal limbo, languishing there for nearly 2 decades. That's while their proceedings have been delayed at the pretrial estate for several years. That justifies why Guantanamo Bay Prison is a symbol of lingering U.S. injustice. And while the Biden administration has said it wants to close the facility, the prison officials have confirmed that a $15 million expansion is underway, including the construction of a new courtroom and workspaces.
Well, it's only because of the power of the United States that it can continue to operate. It's clearly in violation of international law. And people are held without charge in many cases. And so it's just been a travesty, a disaster, a catastrophe for the people involved in it. And again, it's clearly not legal for the United States government to do this, to pick up people anywhere in the world and then to hold them indefinitely, to abuse them, waterboard them, torture them in other ways, and consign them to what seems to be endless imprisonment.
With the prisoners stuck in a legal limbo, an international outcry against torture and injustice, the Guantanamo Bay prison continues to operate. It looks highly unlikely that Joe Biden will manage to remove what human rights advocates call a stain on America's global image. Following the 9/11 terrorist attacks, the U.S. administration led by then-President George W. Bush declared a war on terror and invaded Afghanistan in October 2001. 20 years later, the chaotic withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan marked the end of a protracted war that cost thousands of lives and trillions of dollars. 20 years of intervention in order to protect Afghanistan and to build a decent defensive military force for the nation. However, Kabul's pack of cards collapsed as the Taliban took over the country with no trouble. Afghanistan is a perfect example of the U.S. hegemony and military presence under the pretext of fighting terrorism. A big failure for a nation that feels it has to police the world. As of July 2021, the U.S. has more than 750 military bases in at least 80 countries worldwide. The actual number is probably higher, as the Pentagon has not published all the data. Washington entered the Middle East in a bid to hunt the man who they believed masterminded the 9/11 attacks, the Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, who was harbored by the Taliban in Afghanistan. They later invaded Iraq in 2003. Up to 3 million U.S. service members have served in Afghanistan and Iraq since 2001, with over half of them deployed more than once. The U.S. also has had an active military presence in Japan since the end of World War II and in South Korea since the Korean War in the 50s. Nearly half of the U.S. military forces deployed abroad are stationed in these two countries, with 80,000 service members. Elsewhere, Europe is home to some 60,000 American troops. Meanwhile, the U.S.'s most controversial and oldest military base abroad is located in Cuba, the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base. The U.S. has controlled the base since the end of 19th century. Since 2002, the naval base has contained a military prison to hold inmates in a place neither the U.S. nor international law applied. Since then, Guantanamo has been synonymous with human rights abuses perpetrated by the U.S. government in the name of terrorism.
Well, the impulse behind the United States transition from Republican democracy to empire started in the early 1990s with the fall of the Soviet Union, and that is when the acceleration of the U.S. military-based development expanded greatly, because the military-industrial complex, the general defense contractors, the bankers were seeking a transition to empire. And with the crumbling of the Soviet Union, they exploited these opportunities to try and position U.S. bases all around Russia with the agenda to cannibalize it, and had the self-supporting delusion that the United States was now the heir apparent to dominate and control the world.
In 2020, the U.S. was the largest military spender in the world and more than the next 10 countries combined, as it has spent $778 billion on its military. Over the past two decades, the U.S. has spent $8 trillion on its so-called war on terror that only caused more instability across the globe. The U.S. military intervention as a whole is responsible for the creation of Daesh terrorists. If the U.S. hadn't invaded Iraq in 2003, and if Washington and its allies hadn't backed opposition groups and Al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, Daesh would never have formed. Following the 9/11 attacks and the declaration of war on Afghanistan in 2001 and Iraq in 2003, the U.S. saw a large spike in the number of its troops abroad. At least 800,000 Americans served in Afghanistan and more than 1.5 million in Iraq over the past 20 years. The human cost of the U.S. so-called war on terror is estimated to have killed more than 900,000 people, mostly civilians.
It not only violates the sovereignty of individual nations where the U.S. has forcibly impregnated itself in and established military bases in these countries, but it more importantly violates the fundamental core of our human existence. God made men and women to be free and to seek Him and to enjoy life on earth, not to exist as a slave to another. And the United States and its military expansion and its ambitions for bases really is a transformation of slavery.
It seems the U.S. aim behind all these military bases is to exert its own foreign policy directives under the pretext of policing the world. Although supported by international legal agreements, the presence of foreign troops violates a country's sovereignty.
The coronavirus pandemic has not only cost countless lives, but has hit the world economy hard. The United States, which has the world's biggest economy, hasn't been an exception. The U.S. is the world's worst-hit nation by the pandemic. Under former President Donald Trump, the country launched a program called Operation Warp Speed to to facilitate and accelerate the production and distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. U.S. pharmaceutical companies developed several vaccines and rolled them out to the country's population. Trump's successor, Joe Biden's administration, set a target of vaccinating 70% of the country's population, at least partially, by the 4th of July. However, the country met the target a month later, despite generous incentives given to Americans.
At least 40% of the U.S. population is a victim of a lot of silly conspiracy theories about the vaccine and are adamant about not taking the vaccine. It's a big problem in the U.S. that's been stoked by social media and QAnon and, you know, career right-wing politicians who are manipulating it all for their personal gain. So the U.S. Is confronting with this real problem.
The vaccination program proved effective at bringing down the daily COVID cases and deaths, but up to a certain point. The highly infectious Delta variant of the coronavirus sent a new wave of cases and fatalities across the world. Scrambling to contain the spiraling outbreak, President Biden announced new mandatory vaccination plans on Thursday.
I will sign an executive order that will now require all executive branch federal employees to be vaccinated. All. And I've signed another executive order that will require federal contractors to do the same. If you want to work with the federal government and do business with us, get vaccinated.
But in addition to saving lives, the U.S. government is aiming at saving the economy, too.
Well, it certainly would help because we have a problem going on of a lot of workers not wanting to go back to work now that the COVID Delta variant is accelerating in a lot of places in the country. That was obvious in the last month's job report.
The mandatory vaccination program has triggered a backlash from American conservatives. Hours after the Democratic U.S. president announced a coronavirus vaccine mandate for federal workers, Republicans lambasted the decision, suggesting that it's unconstitutional. Figures, including Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel, threatened to take legal action against the Biden administration. A majority of the critics are questioning the administration's authority to declare such a mandate. Back in March, the Democrats in the U.S. Congress passed a bill for a $1.9 trillion coronavirus stimulus package without a single vote from Republican lawmakers. The plan was intended to send direct payments of up to $1,400 per person to the majority of American households, extend a $300 per week unemployment insurance supplement, and put funds into vaccine distribution. The Republicans argued that the package was superfluous as the economy was reopening anyway. They believed the economy would suffer down the road, considering how big a figure the bill earmarked.
Well, you know, that's a false argument. What the Republicans are really about is that they don't want to spend on these stimulus programs because if the stimulus programs spending amounts to significant fiscal stimulus, then they'll have to raise taxes on corporations and investors, which means they'll have to reduce some of the generous Trump tax cuts of 2017 that gave $4.5 trillion in tax cuts to corporations and wealthy individuals and investors. They would have to raise taxes, and that's really what it's about. They don't want to raise those taxes. They don't want to take away the Trump tax cuts if they got to have to spend a lot on social programs.
With the United States COVID-19 figures rising in recent weeks, economic indicators are expected to be negatively impacted. Biden's unprecedented and aggressive move to make vaccines mandatory for a considerable portion of the American society can highlight the gravity of the risk the U.S. economy is currently facing from the deadly contagion.
Israel is stepping up its hawkish warmongering rhetoric against Iran. The chief of staff of Israel's military has said the regime is putting more extensive plans in place for when it decides to, quote, attack Iran. Aviv Kohavi claims the regime has, quote, greatly accelerated preparations for action against Iran's nuclear program. He says a considerable increase in the budget has been allocated to that purpose, with more intelligence and operational capabilities assigned. Kohavi also said Israeli military's current main objective is to stem what he called Iran's presence in the Middle East, with an emphasis on Syria and elsewhere. Those operations are taking place all over the Middle East, against Hamas in Palestine, against Hezbollah in Lebanon. Earlier this month, Israeli Minister for Military Affairs Benny Gantz said in an interview that the regime was prepared to attack Iran, saying that, quote, we are at a point where we need to take military action against Iran. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has implicitly acknowledged that the regime has carried out covert attacks on Iran's peaceful nuclear program and brazenly said that the regime would keep on with such attacks.
And the reason behind its stepped-up hostility toward Iran and a very open hostility is that Israel seeks to be the lone superpower, or you could say mini superpower of the region, as a junior partner of the big superpower, the United States.
Iran has already condemned Tel Aviv's reckless rhetoric against Tehran. Late last month, the Iranian envoy to the United Nations warned Israel against any adventurism toward the Islamic Republic. In a letter to the President of the United Nations Security Council, Zahra Ershadi, the Deputy Permanent Representative of Iran to the UN, warned the regime against carrying out its threats of attacking Iran over its peaceful nuclear program. Unchecked, such continued unlawful acts and systematic provocative measures, with all their serious ramifications, would undoubtedly further destabilize the region and also endanger international peace and security.
It was not just when Netanyahu, with all of his ridiculousness, his cartoonish presentations and so forth, his obsession with Iran's development, it's the whole establishment, the whole Israeli establishment that has this extreme hostility toward Iran and wants to continue to take action in the hopes of provoking something.
During Naftali Bennett's visit to the United States last week, Tel Aviv and Washington agreed to form a high-level team to tackle the Iran nuclear issue. Israel's threats against Iran are believed to be aimed at influencing stalled nuclear talks between Tehran and other world powers.
Well, Israel definitely wants to prevent any possibility of success for the a return to the JCPOA, the so-called nuclear deal. And so it's moving in this direction.
However, analysts believe Washington's options outside of diplomacy with Iran are limited. A military option would be unacceptable to the top Pentagon brass, who have engaged in enough war games and other scenarios to recognize that there is no workable military solution. It is believed that Israel presumably recognizes that a military option would also be counterproductive.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال علي عليه السلام العفاف زينة الفقر والشكر زينة الغنى.
Imam Ali said, "The beauty of destitution is chastity, and the beauty of riches is gratefulness." Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, the son of Abu Talib, alayhi salam. Dear friends, the Muslims unanimously believe that the pillars of Islam were strengthened by Imam Ali. And so we find, dear brothers and sisters, dear friends, that Imam Ali, alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, defended the Holy Prophet, which in reality means that he defended the word of Allah and he defended the message of Islam with his body, with his soul, with his heart, and of course with his sword. Now, this defense of Islam at the hands of Imam Ali's sword, of course, is something which cannot be overlooked by history. And thus, history has established as a fact that the sword of Imam Ali is what defended Islam and defended the Messenger of Allah in the most sensitive of times. And so in this relation, there is no one who preceded
or was better than Imam Ali alayhi salam, and there was no one who could reach this position of Imam Ali as the defender of Islam even after Imam Ali alayhi salam. Imam Ali was courageous and valorous in the battlefields. He was Allah's sword, and he was the remover of sorrow from the face of the Holy Prophet, to such an extent that Imam Ali amazed the angels when he attacked the kuffar without any fear and with total courage and bravery. So, dear friends, we are the followers of Imam Ali. And if some of us aren't the followers of Imam Ali, nonetheless, we respect him as the fourth caliph of the Muslims. We respect him as the sword of Islam. We respect him because he is the champion of Islam who protected and defended Islam in its most sensitive of times. Of course, as a Shia Muslim, we respect and love Imam Ali, for he is the successor of the Holy Prophet. He is the first divinely appointed Imam. And so, in any manner that you regard Imam Ali, and you respect Imam Ali, and you love Imam Ali, this is what we learn: to be brave, to be courageous, to defend Islam as much as we possibly can. This, dear friends, a beautiful lesson, the defense of Islam, the protection of Islam, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafiya. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, develop the habit of patience against sufferings, calamities, and adversities. This virtue of patience is one of the highest values of morality and nobility of character, and it is the best habit which one can develop. Trust in Allah and let your mind seek His protection in every calamity and suffering, because you will thus entrust yourself and your affairs to the best trustee and to the mightiest guardian. Do not seek help or protection from anybody but Allah. Reserve your prayers, your requests, your solicitations, your supplications, and your entreaties to Him and Him alone, because to grant, to give, to confer and to bestow, as well as to withhold, to deprive, to refuse, and to debar, lies only in His power. ask as much of his blessings and seek as much of his guidance as you can. Try to understand my exhortation. Ponder over them deeply. Do not take them lightly, and do not turn away from them, because the best knowledge is that which benefits the listener. The knowledge which does not benefit anybody is useless, not valuable, and not worth learning and remembering. My dear son, when I realized that I was getting old, and when I felt that weakness and feebleness are gradually creeping into me, then I hastened to advise you as to the best ways of leading a noble, virtuous, and useful life. I hated the idea that death should overtake me before I tell you all that I wanted to tell, or before my mental capacities, like my bodily strength, are weak.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. And I would like to begin with this very question about Amir al-Mu'mineen. And the question about who is Ali is actually a very simple question. What I want to answer tonight is the question of what is Ali. There is a difference between who is Ali and what is Ali. So you can have the physical Quran, but if you really want the true interpretation of the Quran, you need an Imam who is the waris of the Quran. And therefore, there is no one among the companions of the Prophet has ever claimed what Ali claimed about the Quran. There is no one who has claimed about the Quran among the companions of the Prophet the way Ali has claimed. And what does he say? He says, ask me before you lose me. You know, many places he says, saluni, saluni, qablan tafqiduni. Ask me before you lose me. And then he says, why? He says, for by the one who split the grain and created the soul of the human being, if you ask me which verse of the Quran was revealed at the night time or the daytime, whether it was revealed in Mecca or in Medina, or it was revealed when the Prophet was traveling, or he was stationed in Medina, or whether the ayat was abrogated or the one which abrogated the other ayat, whether the ayat is muhkam and clear, or an ayat which is mutashabih and of a symbolic nature, and whether you need its interpretation or the context in which the revelation came, I shall indeed inform you about it. But remember, having said all this, just to say that Ali is a good teacher and scholar of Quran is not sufficient. There are many, many scholars of Quran in the world, the good ones, the bad ones. And so don't say Ali is a good scholar of the Quran. He is something greater than that. And that is what I would try to explain to when I say what is Ali, especially in the context of the Quran itself.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
in the limelight.
In recent years, doctors and researchers have increasingly realized that many of those who survive an illness of any kind or who go through serious physical trauma are at high risk of a range of debilitating and chronic physical, cognitive, and mental health symptoms, problems that closely resemble long COVID. We now present you an article written by Megan Hosey, an assistant professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. The piece is titled, "Post-illness symptoms like long COVID are probably more common than we think." The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Recent months, long COVID has received a great deal of media and public attention. Research has found that as many as one in four of those infected with COVID, perhaps millions of people in the United States alone, suffer from chronic long-term symptoms, including headaches, dizziness, abdominal pain, heart problems, fatigue, anxiety, depression, cognitive impairment, and other conditions. It is a difficult and complex illness, and we must do much more to help those who are struggling with it. At the same time, it is important to realize that rather than being a strange, special case, long COVID is probably part of the broader phenomena that affects many more people. In recent years, doctors and researchers have increasingly realized that many of those who survive an illness of any kind or who go through serious physical trauma are at high risk from a range of debilitating and chronic physical, cognitive, and mental health symptoms, problems that closely resemble long COVID. Seen in this context, it is not at all surprising that many patients infected with COVID find themselves dealing with an array of persistent health problems. This is not to minimize long COVID in any way, but simply to put it in a broader context. The issue is in part a byproduct of a medical transformation. Over the past half century, as medicine has advanced, clinicians have learned how to save thousands and thousands of severely ill or injured patients who would have previously died. This is a remarkable accomplishment, of course. But in many cases, survival does not mean complete recovery. Some patients find that their bodies, brains, and psyches continue to bear the scars of what they have gone through. One non-COVID study found that a year after hospitalization, a third of patients with severe respiratory failure or shock had significant cognitive impairment. Another found that between a quarter and a third of patients who were treated in the intensive care unit had significant and long-lasting symptoms of anxiety, depression, or post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Researchers have found similar results for survivors of other medical conditions, including cancer, multiple sclerosis, and ALS. Unfortunately, people with long COVID, as well as other chronic post-illness symptoms, often find that the medical establishment doesn't understand their experience, and so minimizes or questions it. This is not surprising. Clinicians tend to pay less attention to how patients with severe illness do once they're out of mortal danger, or once symptoms extend beyond an arbitrary time frame. Researchers do not yet fully understand the physical causes of these chronic symptoms. It is clear that long COVID and long versions of other illnesses and injuries are not psychosomatic. These conditions have a physiologic basis. Among the possible culprits may be persistent dysfunction in inflammatory or immune responses triggered by the initial illness or injury. In some cases, the disease or injury may also leave permanent damage, just as someone with a broken leg may end up walking with a limp. With COVID, this situation may be exacerbated by the specifics of the disease. Chronic symptoms appear to be especially common after serious respiratory illness, which COVID often is. a study of patients who survived acute respiratory failure and received mechanical ventilation in the intensive care unit found that more than 80% of them experienced physical, cognitive, and/or mental health impairments after leaving the hospital. Moreover, COVID can affect a wide array of bodily symptoms, and so there are many possible pathways for it to leave lasting effects. So what can we do to help these people with long COVID or long versions of other conditions? One key is self-management. Patients with chronic post-illness problems can learn to cope effectively with many symptoms related to their condition, making decisions, tailoring their activities, and forming effective relationships with clinicians. Through self-management, patients become active agents in the oversight of their condition. Multiple studies, including this one from 2019, have shown that teaching patients this approach can significantly improve their quality of life. Unfortunately, most hospitals and clinicians are not equipped to teach self-management, and so it is used much less than it could be. Another useful strategy is peer support, which can help patients share information and also become part of a community. The sense of enduring alone can be enormously dispiriting. Of course, it's also important to note that unmoderated peer support can contribute to unhealthy hypervigilance, an excessive focus on symptoms, and the dissemination of misinformation. But patients can do this alone. Healthcare institutions must do more to set up clinics and programs to help people with these problems. And scientists and funding agencies must focus more on unraveling the complex mechanisms that drive these conditions, as well as on potential strategies to reduce symptoms. Beyond that, we must continue to spread the word so that the public understands more about how severe illness and severe injury can often become a long-term condition. Increasing awareness will encourage healthcare providers, funders, families, colleagues, and others to take this situation seriously. Millions of people with long COVID and other similar conditions continue to suffer, and we must do much more to help them.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Aklo Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course.